This podcast may contain adult language and themes, or it might not. We're not really sure. We haven't recorded it yet.
I'm Jason.
I'm Diggs.
I make software, music, and podcasts.
I connect people, personally and professionally, and I like talking with Jason.
This is the Candy Factory 5x5 podcast.
Five conversations.
Five random topics.
5 minutes each.
When we hear this sound,
we move on to the next topic. Next.
On every episode, we invite a very special guest to join us.
Hi, I'm Jose Johnson, and I'm a life coach, personal mastery coach, author, speaker, jack of all trades, Tai Chi master.
You are my Tai Chi master.
I am.
I called him sensei this morning, completely wrong. It was a completely mischaracterized martial arts reference.
Sensei is not proper?
That's Japanese. That means teacher in Japanese.
Oh, so what's a Tai? Is it just master?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, there's a whole litany of things that you could be called, and most of them aren't nice. So
fair enough.
But I've been taking Jose's Tai Chi class.
Yeah, that's Jason-san.
Yeah.
Wait, I thought that was Japanese.
It is. Well,
we're all over the place. So it's great to have you on the program.
Hey, it's fantastic to be here.
Looking forward to another 5x5. This is our 11th episode. That's somehow exciting to me.
That is. 1-1.
Snake eyes.
Yes, exactly.
For anybody who's just joining us, our iPad, his name is Frank, is going to be presenting us with five topics. And we're going to talk about those topics for about 5 minutes, well, not about, exactly 5 minutes each, and then we'll move on to the next topic. Are you ready to roll?
I am absolutely ready to roll.
All right, let's do this. Our first topic for today's episode of 5x5 is Charles Manson.
Oh.
Speaking of Quentin Tarantino, we just talked about Quentin.
I just watched the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I haven't seen it. Please don't spoil it.
You know what? If you're good to me, I'll be good to you.
You're cool with me.
Yeah,
I'll be cool with you.
Exactly. Exactly.
What was that about?
It was kind of this bizarre rambling story about an aging Western actor and his stunt double, and how they kind of intertwined with the Manson family. And it created this kind of weird alternate reality.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to why. I don't know why I haven't watched it yet. Like, I've been kind of waiting to watch it. Because I was all right, this is going to sound weird.
It might not.
But when I was in high school, I wasn't a Manson fan. But I was like, I read Helter Skelter, which is like 800 pages. It was like it was like the only book I read for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got really deep into the story of the murders and everything like that. And
dude just freaked me out. I mean, anytime I saw a picture of those eyes, man, just the wacko eyes. So and that was something actually that got me really kind of aware of the fact that the eyes, and I say the eyes are the windows of the soul. You can look at someone and look at their eyes and just kind of see that there's something devious going on back there.
Yeah,
which is why I try not to look Diggs in the eye too often, because he just really freaks me out.
I'm the basilisk from Harry Potter. I can just freeze you.
Okay,
I'll
Medusa.
Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes.
What do you know about Manson?
So I was just about to ask. So I know the name. I know. Was he the one that had everyone commit suicide?
No.
The one in the jungle?
That was Jim Jones.
Oh. Okay, so I know nothing.
Yeah, Charles Manson is Marilyn Manson's dad.
Right, right.
That's so not true.
I know that's not true.
So Charles Manson was this sort of like hippie leader. Mm. He was sort of this messed up guy in the 60s. He was a bit older than, he was like maybe close to 30.
Mm.
And around 1966, 67, and he basically recruited a bunch of hippies out of San Francisco, like the Summer of Love stuff, and ended up in Los Angeles, and they formed this cult where they were living on a set, an old movie set out in the woods or whatever.
Okay,
not in the woods, but outside of Los Angeles. Mm. And he's just this really strange wannabe rock star kind of guy. There was a lot of famous people actually kind of intersected with him because he was a musician in that area at the time. But he basically got these young kids who were all sort of runaways and kind of doing the hippie thing,
mm-hmm.
Formed this cult. And he went down this completely weird rabbit hole where the Beatles and the Bible intersected, and Manson wanted to start a race war because it was coming, and he wasn't patient enough for it to happen. So his grand scheme was to take his family to start a race war, take his family into the desert.
This is the air quotes family, the runaways.
Yes, yeah. His family of runaways. Take his group of people into the desert and hide out until the black man killed off all the white people, and then they would come out and take over and lead them.
From the black people.
From the black people who killed all the white people. Because that's how fucked up this was.
They would definitely allow
white people. Yeah, exactly. we just killed, you know, like, you know, millions of white people, so now we're gonna let this, like, you know, group of 20
this guy.
So this is also at the height of the Panthers, is it?
Yeah, 1969, right?
Okay. So this is also when, like, Reagan's a governor and he's like trying to take away Second Amendment rights because the NRA at that point.
It was a really bizarre thing, and if you do get a chance to watch the movie because it's great how Tarantino takes the reality and creates this kind of, you know, narrative around it. And
I can't wait to see it. I'm fascinated by that. So anyway, the murders, the famous murders, were them jump starting the race war. So they picked this house, and there were famous people living there. Sharon Tate was a famous actress, married to Roman Polanski.
Yes.
Some others, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, who was like the heir to the Folger, the coffee company. So these people were just hanging out at this house one night, and the Manson's people went in and just killed them, like killed these like five people and painted, you know, with their blood, a piggy and all this kind of stuff on the walls. And then they ended up the next night, or maybe two nights later, but I think it was the next night, going to another house in another part of Los Angeles, not very far away, and killed these other two people randomly to sort of jumpstart this race war. And it kind of, as you know now, no spoiler there, it didn't really work out.
Right.
So, Charles ended up, you know.
Right. But now, so was it specifically the song Helter Skelter? Or like where, or...
Well,
so how did the Beatles?
The so Beatles were speaking to him.
This the backwards music one?
Partly, yeah. Anyway,
got it.
That's all we got about.
That's all we got for Charlie.
I'm glad I. So, topic number two today's 5x5. Completely unrelated to Charles Manson, Apple computers.
I guess I'm pro.
But wait a second. The Beatles, Apple. There's an
Apple. Apple, there is a connection.
Apple Records.
There is a connection. Wow. Absolutely.
We made that connect.
We could keep it going.
No, so what do you think about Apple computers?
I hate that I'm so tied into them. Not gonna
lie.
The
ecosystem.
Yeah, but it started, I was a PC person for most of my, like, for high school, college, and then I was on a, like, bereavement leave from my studies at F&M, and ended up working at this startup that eBay had in New York called eBay Now. And they were pretty much all Mac-based. Mm-hmm. So, like, you got a work iPhone, you had a... you could pick a PC, but I was like, well, why would I pick a thing that can't communicate with
the other
iMessage properly? Since everybody else in the field was on iMessage, I don't want to have to juggle devices. So then, once I started working there and then had a work laptop that was a Mac and the work iPhone, I kind of got sucked into being all Mac.
You bought into the system. You sold out, Diggs.
I guess I did.
Yeah, I guess.
And now I'm just tied into the convenience of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've done a great job sort of keeping you in, like bringing you in, tying you into this ecosystem and then keeping you there.
Yeah.
I'm sure a very intentional strategy for many, many decades. But
yeah, it's digital crack, basically.
Are you a Mac user?
I am not a Mac user. I refuse.
Good for you.
I stand it up. Stand my ground.
Well,
now, you know, I guess it's because I'd invested so much in PC and PCs. And this is, you know, of course, prior to the point where now, you know, you have the dual OSs on Macs. But I just was so invested in all my PC stuff. And I just actually like not being a Mac user. I like being the oddball.
Well, are you like an Android?
Yeah, I'm an Android user. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, one of the interesting things about Apple versus non-Apple computers, when I first really deep dived into computing would be the late 90s. I wasn't an early adopter. I didn't have a lot of money in the 90s, so I wasn't buying, you know, Macs in like 90, 91, 92. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that was, you know, a very distinct difference is that, you know, the Windows operating system would run on the hardware of multiple companies.
Right.
And Apple controlled the whole package. Yeah. And so I think that's where that quality and that quality perception sort of, it kind of wasn't the fault of Windows, in the sense that, you know, they're building an operating system that who knows what hardware that's going to be on, and where that hardware was made, and right. what factory and what quality of actual, you know, pieces mm-hmm. there were. So, you know, people would really give PCs a hard time, and, you know, especially Mac snobs, and it would just be like, yeah, but it's kind of a completely different thing, like in right. the sense yeah. of that quality control, or being able to control the entire package.
Right, yeah, there's that being able to micromanage everything, and, you know, make sure that everything is going to work together. And, yeah, that's the one downfall of Windows. Yeah, plus I hate their updates. But, yeah. Well, it's funny because I had when I was on the road, one of the guys in the band, his dad was a engineer at IBM. My friend, of course, then went out immediately and bought a Macintosh. We actually used to call him Danny Macintosh back in the day because we're using a lot of sequencing on stage. But yeah, he didn't want to have anything to do with PC and PC based stuff. He was Macintosh.
Was the perception of Mac then that it was like for musicians, or?
Well, it was always kind of for creatives.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, yeah. But I didn't know if there was like a specific like marketing angle.
No, not so much. Okay. I mean, yeah, now definitely if you're in any kind of design or, you know, creative stuff, the Mac seems to be the computer du jour. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I do like them. I like a lot of the things about it, but, you know, I can understand from a marketing perspective, a business perspective of having everything like locked into that ecosystem. But, you know, on the other hand, it pisses me off that, you know, I can't communicate right, well with other right. devices. So,
well, I think yeah. things. I think that as a Mac user, I think things really kind of went downhill after Jobs died. And I feel like the way I say it is this: Macs used to be the best, and I would buy them because they were the best computer out there. Mm. Now I feel like that Macs, there's just nothing better. Like at this point, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's not that they are the best. It's not like they're knocking it out of the park. It's just that tripping over, you know, and HP
yeah.
and the Windows updates, and trying to make that all kind of work with like you said, Diggs, like with my phone or with my iPads or these other things. It's like right. tripping over that versus buying a Mac. It's just, I'm going to buy a Mac at the end of the day.
Well, what update? I wanted to know what these Windows updates were because I don't get to see it. But.
Well, maybe next time.
Yeah.
But I do have an update for 5x5, and that is topic number 3.
Oh,
funny. Which is Lancaster City Restaurant.
Boom. Ooh, we were just talking about this
before we
entered the room. Acquaintance, she's a friend, is putting together a networking event for restaurants, and I think it's mostly just restaurants, in March. And I happened to stumble on it when I walked in to the, this is also, I guess, slight plug, unintentional, for the Candy Factory and just the way things work. I just was saying hi to her, and then she's like, wait a minute, you know people, who should I be inviting
to this thing?
And then Jose happened to walk up and like had 3 or 4 great suggestions right off the top.
that's the Candy Factory.
Yeah, it is.
So what's your favorite Lancaster City restaurant?
Oh, well, I think I might be on record as saying, if I just want a good meal, like usually I want a burger, so I'm going to Horse Inn. But Luca is so close to me. If I want good pizza, the Fridge is a go-to. I would describe the Fridge as like, they do have good food you can put together to be a meal, but like I wouldn't tell people go there for your pizza dinner.
Sure. No, that makes sense. It's more snacky, even though it's like.
Sorry, Kevin and Fuddy, if you're listening, but I hope you agree with me.
have you?
They do a great job.
Have you done the brunch at Luca?
I have not.
Oh my god.
Ooh.
Oh my god. They do this sticky bun that's made with croissant. As opposed to like, you know, the typical, you know, thick cakey.
Look, you had me at sticky bun. Oh, so well, you know,
I'm just saying.
Oh,
yeah, they. But yeah, it is to die for. for sure.
Is that your favorite restaurant in the city?
You know, it depends on my mood. I'm much like Diggs. I do love Luca, and I have some you know, great memories of that place. I can eat pretty much anywhere. I love Hunger and Thirst. That's another one of my favorite places. Any place that's got a good bar, fundamentally, that gets bonus points for me.
Well, I just realized we probably should have broken down by which meal we're talking about.
That's true.
Because, like, dinner is horse end for sure. But, like, lunch, Monday, Friday, or Friday through Monday, I'm going to On Orange, I think. You both know that because I want my breakfast for lunch. If they're not open, then I'm going to Sprout or Rice and Noodle, or I'm sure the Caballar right across the street here. So I guess it also depends on which meal we're talking about.
So where
we got taking, 5 minutes. We can't really get that.
Where are you taking us for lunch after this? That's the question.
I brought leftovers in.
Sorry. You know, for my money. So here's the thing. Lancaster City has really seen what I think is a pretty dramatic explosion of new restaurants in the last, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I go back to Dipco. I just always go back to Dipco.
How did I forget? Yeah.
Oh.
You know, I'm not feeling it, man. I don't know. I've been there a few times, and it's one of those things where there's nothing on that menu that's bad, but there's nothing on the menu that's outstanding to me. But it makes me go, you know.
But it's not supposed. It's not supposed to be a culinary experience.
Well,
it's
supposed
to be like. It's
kind of a neighborhood bar kind of.
Yeah, thing. It's really good bar food.
Oh yeah,
it's
excellent
bar
food. Yeah. But I think it's for me. You know, my palate is not very complex. All right. So and what I mean by that is I will go to these fancy sort of foodie restaurants and I will order the thing that I can't pronounce and it doesn't, you know what I mean? Like it might be good. There might be a little flavor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I don't get blown away by it. I just don't think that I'm a foodie kind of guy.
That's fair.
And then as a result of that, I end up spending all this money on this food, and then I usually end up with like an upset stomach or something. Yeah. And then I'm just like, why did I do that? But when I go back to Dipco, it's inexpensive,
it's
consistent, super friendly, awesome people that work there. That's why I go back.
Yeah, you know, and that's
my favorite restaurant.
That's the thing. I am a bit of a foodie, and I do enjoy going to a very, you know, nice, high-class kind of restaurant, but I also just like comfort food. You know, there's just like days where all I want is, you know, meatloaf and mashed potatoes.
Right.
You know, but then
big ass bowl of stew.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's what I love about Lancaster. I mean, when I was living in Harrisburg, there were some decent restaurants there, but man, down here, it's like I just trip
over them.
Yeah, yeah. Which is,
I think we're at a bubble right now where it's kind of diluted, and I think that'll even itself out in the next couple of years. I want to say though, real quick, that my favorite restaurant in Central Pennsylvania is Millworks in Harrisburg.
I
go to dinner at Millworks. Like, I will drive an hour.
Millworks, just sign that.
Yeah, that's a decent
hands
place.
Down.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's fair.
I need a good steakhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's all we got. Yeah. Well, for topic number 3.
This is true.
It is now time for topic number 4 of this episode's 5x5, which is Netflix documentaries. We were talking about Netflix in a previous episode, but not next. Well,
No. Us yesterday.
Us
in, just in the co-workingness, you mentioned a documentary that you were lamenting the fact that the breadth of Netflix documentaries is not really there.
It's not, but I will say this. I believe that Netflix reinvented the documentary, meaning, kind of. The surge of popularity of documentary was a direct result of some of the good documentaries Netflix had like 5, 6, 7 years ago.
That they produced or they just happened
That they produced and or took and distributed, right? Making a Murderer is its top of mind like 5 years ago that sort of took, like it was sort of like Serial for podcasting. It just, everybody just went nuts about it.
Fair point.
That one holiday season.
Yeah.
And it was this docuseries. And I'm not a binger, but I couldn't stop watching that bloody thing. And as a result, like, I don't know, Netflix documentaries there's a, it's like a fan of, I'm a fan of Netflix documentaries specifically.
Jose? No, I'm, you know, I am not with you on that.
Are you a documentary snob?
I am a documentary snob.
Oh my
yeah,
God.
The closest I've come to a documentary on Netflix was Dolomite.
Oh my Lord.
But no, I mean, I just, I don't know. I just don't really watch documentaries.
I don't.
Okay. But then
you wouldn't agree at all that Netflix reinvigorated the whole idea.
They did not for me. Yeah. So therefore, that is a fallacy.
Do you like any documentaries?
I'm not a huge documentary kind of guy. Or anything? You know, not really.
All right, Diggs. Okay.
Well, you can talk to Diggs.
Well, so I was going to say for me, what got me into documentaries, and maybe this doesn't count, but the CNN Decade series.
Yeah, it absolutely counts.
Well, I didn't know if it was like overly stylized and like not like, because they really do try to bring the I don't want to say the pop to those stories, but it's, you know, it there's just a, they package it up in like specific bent. It's not like it's a year to year like anthology.
Right?
It's,
no, I get it.
You know, like the assassinations of the 60s, and then like, you know, the times they almost went to
the
war.
Greatest
in the 50s.
Hits of the 60s.
Right. So I didn't know.
I thought that was a great series.
I still loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. But. And I think that certainly was around that time as well. There was there was just a lot of good. I feel like that when I was a kid, documentaries were really, really boring PBS shows, right? And then in the 90s, like, it seems like people tried, right? And there were some weird kind of documentaries from that time, and people were exploring things. And then Ken Burns did, well, that would be, early 90s?
Yeah.
He did the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that sort of changed the game, right? So that, to me, was like a huge game changer in the sort of world of documentaries. And his style changed things, right, with the whole zoom in on the photos and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, but it didn't seem like it. There was a, it's not like that documentaries became like a movie theater thing. Right, so theaters weren't running documentaries the way that they run blockbuster holiday or Hollywood movies. But then what I feel like is that with the streaming services in particular, Netflix being probably the most popular one, it just seemed to really open up this whole flood. That, and you know what else? Drones. You can't, drones, like drone footage.
Oh.
Like
yes,
every
okay.
documentary opens with drone, you know what I mean? It's like becoming...
Right. Here's the battlefield from where they used to have the shadow of the helicopter, like in the shot. Like,
exactly. You know, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I remember like when HBO was kind of making its name, that they used to do a whole lot of documentary series and things like that, and, you know, behind the scenes and all that sort of.
Back in like in the 80s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to kind of die down.
Yeah, and again, as a kid, I was a teenager in the 80s, and it was like, you know, that kind of stuff wasn't dramatic enough. It wasn't, you know, but the way that the Netflix sort of, the Netflix style of documentary, because they produce a lot of original content now, and I think Making a Murder really was the beginning of that, where they were like, because that documentary was actually filmed a long time before Netflix picked it up. It was like, the two women who did it were intrigued by the case, and they were independent filmmakers. They went and they shot the whole first part of that documentary like 10 or 15 years before Netflix picked it up. When the original trials were happening, they were shooting it in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Then they ended up, you know, finishing it or selling it to Netflix or however, whatever that deal was.
Mm-hmm.
But it really was a kind of, everybody was talking about it that one Christmas, and next thing you know, there's a lot of especially true crime documentaries that sort of mimic that format of what they did.
Another good thing, 30 for 30 on ESPN.
Yes.
You used to watch those.
Yeah.
I agree. Look at you, Jose, pulling back the curtain.
Yeah.
Our final topic for today's episode of 5x5 is Pink Floyd.
The Pink Floyd or?
Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd.
So this is kind of a strange thing. I think there's some mysticism going on with this episode, because it seems like every topic has a reference, like from the last 24, 48. Like you were saying, literally, Jose sent a meme, a Pink Floyd meme,
Dark Side of Your Mom,
and tagged me in it. In Slack, like yesterday, saying, like, we were just talking about Netflix documentaries yesterday. But there's some weird, something's going on,
and we're talking about
something going on. So where are you at with Pink Floyd, Diggs?
I know they're a band.
Okay.
And they're pink.
Yes. I know their songs are very long.
Some of them.
Okay, fair. Some of fair. Them. I'm sorry. The songs I know are very long. I know that Dark Side of the Moon is an album.
It's
got
album.
A cool prism on it. I think it's a prism.
Yes. Is that it?
I think that's it.
That's about as far as it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What was the why did, what sparked the interest in sending the meme, and then you guys can talk about the band.
Well, because Jason, San, and I kind of have these running conversations about music and things like that. And we actually were talking, I think, not the last happy hour, but the one before that, we were talking about a Pink Floyd tribute band, weren't we?
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. I was watching a game, I think, a football game, and I was flipping between to PBS. There was a Brit Floyd is a tribute band to Pink Floyd. They were playing at Red Rocks.
Whoa.
Like, so you're a band and you're big enough. Mm-hmm. You've made such an impact on culture that your tribute band is playing at one of the most coveted venues in the country. That's pretty remarkable.
That's impressive.
But yeah, so I mean, Floyd was always like my Beatles. You know what I mean? Like, they were the band that, the legendary band that sort of, you know, changed it all for me in terms of my interest in music, my taste in music, like the lineage of the stuff that I listen to kind of comes down from them. And I always think of Floyd as sort of my Beatles. When I say that, I mean, you know, like a lot of musicians point back to the Beatles as sort of the starting point. But it's Floyd. I just love him. Absolutely love him.
Yeah, I was kind of counterculture. Well, actually, I guess not counterculture in many ways, but a lot of my friends were into Floyd and Rush and, you know, which meant that I would not listen to it at all, period. Yeah, if my friends were listening to it.
So Floyd was like your Mac.
My Mac, exactly. Yeah.
What were you listening to when your friends were into, I guess in the 70s, the Prague, the rise of Prague?
Yeah, I mean, I was, at that point, I was a little more pop and still getting in my jazz phase, funk. But, later on, I started to really listen to a lot more stuff. So I started getting into more prog and Crimson and, and, you know, a little bit of Rush and Pink Floyd. And I found that their stuff was definitely a little ahead of its time.
Yeah, sure.
You know, conceptually, and the way they put everything together. And that's one of the things I think is missing in music these days, is that well-thought-out concept of the visual, the music, and not just visuals from the way we do it now. The crap that goes on, all the, you know, we got to have 60 million dancers and that sort of thing. But, you know, having an actual storyline that permeates the album and the visuals that they go with that. And of course, you know, I love sitting there with the album cover,
right,
and
the
artwork and the liner notes and stuff. And it was a well put together package, man.
It definitely was. And they really did take art, like the art of rock music, to a new level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's some great documentaries. Speaking of documentaries that, you know, one in particular I watched recently, which was about the making of Wish You Were Here, and that album, 1975, and it was post Dark Side of the Moon, so they were huge. They were a huge band, and it was sort of like, what do you do as a follow-up? And they created this record, and the depth of visual, the visuals that wrapped around the record, not just in the concert, like you're saying, but the artwork, right, and everything was just so layered and so deep. It was, and that's, you know, when you look back at the history of rock and roll, I mean, prior to that, there wasn't that much other bands that were taking it to that level. I mean, the Beatles obviously did stuff like that with their latter part of their career. But
It was more than just the pyrotechnics and things like that. You know, it was just, there was that really well thought out and programmed visual component to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is anyone, are any people, I guess, doing that well these days?
I think Radiohead.
Was what came to mind to me, but I didn't know. I didn't want to put words in
your mouth. If there's a today Pink Floyd, in my opinion, it's, you know, or a later Pink Floyd, it's Radiohead.
Do you have
as
one?
As far as depth.
Jose?
No.
Okay.
That's it. Fastest 25 minutes in podcasting.
Seriously.
Fastest 25 minutes.
Man.
Jose, what do you think?
I thought it was great, except for I couldn't get a word in edgewise sometimes with Diggs over there.
It's a fantastic pleasure to have you on the program, Jose Johnson. Thank you.
It is my pleasure. I love you, guys. Diggs, thanks, man.
Thank you, Sensei.
Thanks, Jason Son.
The Candy Factory 555 podcast is recorded at the studios of The Candy Factory, a co-working campus in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
The show is produced and hosted by Jason Mundock,
along with co-host Robert Diggs, regularly joining the Yakety Yakking.
The opinions and views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the expressor.
The Candy Factory is not in any way responsible if anyone said something stupid.
Our theme music was composed
and recorded by a really cool guy.
Really cool guy.
A really cool guy.
Really cool guy named John Chin.
Relevant links and show notes can be found on the show post
at the Candy Factory website.
CoworkingInLancaster.com.
Maybe that's it.
Is that it? Okay.